Talking today with Jessica Farrar, State Representative in House District 148, also my state representative. Jessica, tell me, what's your view of the session that just ended? What do you think was your biggest accomplishment from the last legislative session?
Gosh, well, there were a lot of things. Starting backwards, so from the end of the session forwards, I guess it was the defeat of the governor's so-called Homeland Security bill. We raised a lot of questions about the database that...
The TDEX database,
right,
so-called.
Right. And so what we kept arguing, and I think we were successful in the argument, not, of course, Republicans didn't see it that way, but we were saying put the database with people that do databases, i.e. DPS, because what the governor wanted to do was keep it in the governor's office, and so the governor would be taking data on individuals. You had no idea what was being taken on you, who was in the database, and so on. But they're not people that do this stuff, and so we didn't want it to be misused for political reasons. And so DPS already has in its structure a place where, you know, they handle databases, and from what we understood was that if a database, you know, you can get cut off from the national databases, so your access to the national databases, if we would be compromised, and I think we would be compromised if it was in a political office. So anyway, so HB 13 died, and the other thing is it was we in the testimony they were giving money to county sheriffs along the border, and the county sheriffs had nothing to show for their efforts. You know, drugs apprehended, it was almost nothing. In fact, when we talked to DPS, DPS said what we do is we set up long-term stings, and we collect information. They have informants, and they also plant people, undercover people, and they try to bring down larger networks instead of just, you know, pulling people over and that sort of thing. And what the sheriffs were basically catching were people and but it was a feel-good kind of thing, and a political feel-good kind of thing. But anyway, so we stopped that in its tracks. And then before that, let's see, we started the session with a vaccine.
Yeah, you were a central figure in the HPV vaccine saga, if you will. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, I filed a bill in November. I'd heard about the vaccine, and I thought it was a really great thing that women would be protected from what could be life-threatening. It could be also life-threatening, but. More women are affected that don't reach the final stages of cervical cancer. Anyway, so I'd heard about this vaccine, and I said this is something that, you know, we need to get to women in Texas. And so my bill was a simple bill, and it was just to add this to the list of mandated vaccines. And so next thing I know, the governor issues an executive order, basically passing my bill, doing what we wanted to do with the vaccine, and then
there was a huge backlash.
Yeah, everything broke, and it really bothers me that, you know, if this was some other vaccine, if this was a testicular cancer vaccine, I mean, it would be written in the Constitution. But, you know, in this situation, it everybody freaked out about it, and you know, I looked at all the data. The data was good. The data was safe. But the far right, you know, made this about abstinence and about, you know, all these other things that it had nothing to do with. And so, unfortunately, for the first time in our state, we have a prohibition on a vaccine. So we can't have this vaccine for 5 years to be mandated. So it's a terrible thing, because there will be a group of women who are not going to get the vaccine that could have had the vaccine. And, you know, you get this vaccine, I don't know how much you know all about it, but you get the vaccine it's only good prior to exposure to the virus. And so that's why the Centers for Disease Control puts it in the set of vaccinations that are given in the sixth grade. And so somehow, you know, the far right turned this into that's going to make, you know, 11-year-olds run out and have sex. Well, that's simply not the case. It's going to protect them from having the effects of cervical cancer, and pre-cervical cancer is what gets most women. And so that's, you know, that starts to show up in their early 20s and through their 30s. But the effects of that are you get precancerous cells on the cervix, and they need to be removed or they will progress on full-blown cancer. And so that when you remove them, they're frozen off, they're burnt off, or they're cut or sliced. And you know, there's four or five different ways that the OBGYN removes the cells. And so it compromises the cervix, and so it compromises a woman's ability to have children in the future when and if she decides to do that. So, and of course, that's the bulk of the women that are in that situation. But it could go on, and you could get full-blown cancer that could spread to the uterus, that could spread to, you know, all other internal organs.
In retrospect, do you think we would have been better off if there hadn't been the executive order? I mean, do you think your bill would have had a chance of passing?
Actually, it's you know, it's good and bad, the executive order. I think if you hadn't issued an executive order, it would have been dead. No one would have ever known anything about the vaccine. We would have never even gotten a hearing. We would have never, I mean, this is a conservative legislature. We would have never, it's averse to science, and it's averse to anything that really, that upsets the far right, basically. And so we are, everybody, every other Texan is subject to that mentality. And so there would have been no attention on the vaccine at all. And so, you know, you could argue that we shouldn't have had an executive order, but, and I wouldn't have done it that way, but of course Rick Perry didn't do what I tell him to do. And he certainly didn't call me on this at all. And so, but I think, you know, my motivations for it was to protect women and to prevent them from the disease that they can now avoid. But, I mean, I wish it had been there for me. I know a lot of women stepped forward. In fact, some legislators told me their wives had had precancerous cells on their cervix and had gone through these different procedures. And so, anyway.
So here we go. You mentioned that you know, you didn't think your bill would have had much of a chance had Governor Perry not done what he did. I mean, you know, given, you know, as you say, the conservative nature of the legislature, you know, how do you get stuff done? How do you feel you're effective in a legislature that's not really aligned with your own perspectives and priorities?
It'd be very creative. We do it in a number of ways. Well, one is I pass legislation that's not in my name. You know, I have some Republican colleagues that even when we don't see eye to eye, we have mutual respect. And so I was able to, for instance, amend a piece of legislation that was coming through that requires trucks to that are within a certain distance of schools, neighborhoods. Well, I added neighborhoods. It was originally schools and churches, and I said, what about neighborhoods? Can we add neighborhoods? And so we did, and it requires idling trucks, like a truck stop. So we have a truck stop in the district on Patton and 45. We would require them, now that we have the technology, to plug in instead of idling all night long. And that neighborhood Silverdale, you know, for years has put up with rattling windows and the exhaust and so on. And we just haven't, there haven't been the tools in place to remedy that situation. So anyway, that was one success. And then another one, I'm just surprised that they let, I give Republicans just such grief. I call them up on, you know, I'm on the front lines, and I'm surprised they let me actually pass a bill in my name. But I passed another bill that allows Avenue CDC and other nonprofit developers to exempt them from the Texas Residential Construction Commission. And I say that in the environment that I battle the TRCC all the time, and I let I've done, you know, I've been interviewed on Texas Monthly and other publications talking about how consumers have lost their rights before the Texas Residential Construction Commission, and nonetheless they worked with me to pass this little bill. So and then the other thing, I think, you know, our roles have changed. In 2003, when Craddock became Speaker, Republicans took over, and Democrats helped Craddock become Speaker, I should say. Craddock's not Speaker because of Republicans, he's Speaker because of Democrats. A handful of Democrats that, you know, committed long ago. Anyway, so when that occurred, I'd gone from being a two-term member of the Appropriations Committee and passing whatever bills I needed passed to deciding, become complicit with this regime and accept, you know, the fruits or the chairmanships or whatever, you know, the things they dangle. promises of legislation passed and so on, or stand up for the things that these folks are taking away. And so I decided to stand up. I decided things that I believed in mattered more than the promise that, by the way, these promises for many of my colleagues that went the other direction, that became complicit, they never got passed. They got chairmanships of committees that have no meaning and have memberships where they can't get anything out of there that's significant. And so that was really a turning point for me in my legislative career and also personally, because it's taken a lot of courage and a lot of energy and a lot of creativity. And so the other way that I've influenced the process is by educating my fellow legislators on different issues. And so I started two caucuses, the Environmental Caucus and the Women's Health Caucus. And so my goal with those is to get people, because you'd be surprised, some of the progressive people aren't on board on some issues because really they just, you know, we're a part-time legislature, and so everybody, when we're out of session, everybody goes back to their jobs and lives and so on. And so what I asked in these caucuses was, give me one afternoon of a month, and, you know, we're going to talk, bring experts in to talk about environmental issues that affect our area, or affect our state, and so on. And so that was really helpful, because when SB 12 came to the floor, and it was so-called an environmentally friendly bill. By the way, none of our bills, a lot of more people filed good environmental bills this session that had been coming to the meetings, but of course none of the good stuff got even a hearing. So when SB 12 came to the floor, it was Representative Bonin, Chairman Bonin was carrying it on the House side. And so everybody was trying to amend. And Bonin was very obstinate and kept threatening to pull down his good environmental. It was good, but it wasn't great and by any measure. But anyway, so we amended our stuff to his bill. And that day I actually had a doctor's appointment. And so, long story short, it was a detente and so on, but the next day I came in on third reading of the bill and with my amendment. And Bonin and I had not been part of a deal that he'd cut with the other folks on the second reading of the bill and said, don't offer the amendments or I'll take these certain ones. So the one I was trying to amend was one dealing, adding five chemicals to the ambient air standards. So I was trying to get standards on these five, the five worst ones, formaldehyde, nickel, benzene, butadiene, I forget the other one. But anyway, so we'd have something to measure. Anyway, but we got that. And we went through several days of Bonin pulling his bill down, but I wasn't going to back down to him. And so anyway, finally someone whispered in his ear and said, you know, you've gotten a few days of bad press on this. Just add the amendment. So he took the amendment. What he was trying to avoid was allowing Republicans to cast a bad vote on environmental stuff, so they wouldn't tick off the chemical council folks and their supporters and so on. Anyway, but these are the things that, you know, we as opponents to this regime, what we do is we mitigate the damage, we call attention to matters that would just normally just sail on through, and we also, like I said, you know, we try to work within the system as well. So
you talked about Speakocratic. You were one of the first Democrats to vote against him for Speaker in 2005, along with Lon Burnham, who was the only one to cast a vote against him in 2003, and mm-hmm. he rewarded you by putting you on the Agricultural Committee that mm-hmm. That session. You know, here we are in 2008. The last session showed that there's a lot of dissension in the ranks, not just from Democrats and Republicans, over the way Tom Craddock rules. You know, where do we stand on that? How do we go forward?
Well, that's why elections matter, and that's why I think tides are turning. I think winning that seat in Fort Worth says a lot. That was a seat we weren't supposed to win, but that tells me there's something in the air if, you know, if in Fort Worth a Democrat can win in a solidly, you know, Republican district. And I expect more good things. I think the voters are just kind of tired of the corruption of they're paying more and getting less for everything. I mean, insurance, taxes, everything. And so I think they're just kind of tired of, okay, what. And I think they're also, I think Republicans are running out of groups to go beat up on. I think they got the gays, they got the African Americans, they got the, they're on the immigrants right now. I don't know who's next, but they're running out of groups. So, you know, elections matter. And I think we came, you know, we did come within 3 votes last session of getting rid of Craddock. And I think we can. And the reason it's important to get new leadership is because the speaker sets the agenda. The most important vote is the vote on the first day to decide who's going to be our leader. And, you know, in Texas, the body itself elects the speaker. The people don't elect the speaker. And so it's important that we get someone in there that's going to set an agenda that is good for our families, good for our neighborhoods, good for our jobs, good for our economy, and all these things, instead of what we've seen. We've seen college tuition go up. We've seen less children getting health care. We've seen taxes actually going up. So we're taxing more. So in other areas, so we can pay for your tax breaks over here, and just any number of things. But we've seen people lose their ability to take a case to court. Only wealthy people can now take cases to court. And so anyway, I'm talking about it, you know, accidents and those types of cases. So anyway, it's important who's at the top, because that person sets the agenda and also makes up, as you were talking about earlier, makes up the committee memberships. And so that, you know, that's where bills are heard or not heard.
You have a primary opponent this cycle. When people go to the polls on March 4th, why should they vote for you this year?
Because I still have work to be done, and I'm trying every time to be more, every session or every term to be more and more relevant. I think we've seen people that stay in office a long time become less and less relevant. I'm trying to become more and more relevant. I've invested a lot in taking positions that actually have been a detriment to my political career to be probably to go to higher office or so on. But I'm there to protect people's rights, and I think it's sometimes they're not popular fights, but I think somebody's got to do it, and somebody's got to stand on principle, and I'm still willing to do that. And I'm actually improving my skills. A few years ago, I took a course at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and now I'm in law school trying to sharpen my skills so that next time I go up against the governor or whoever the big dog is, I mean, I will have better abilities to do that.
Your primary opponent, talking about law school, your primary opponent says that you're spending too much time in Austin at law school and not spending enough time in the district. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting coming from someone who just moved into the district, so I think maybe he might be mistaken because he hasn't been around enough to know the things that we do. The cantina hearings that I attend at the county to shut down the nuisance cantinas, and also the legislation I've carried to make it harder to be a bad cantina owner. The work that I've done promoting rail, the work that I've done mitigating the impact of the highways on I-45 and I-10 onto the neighborhoods of the near north side and Woodland Heights, and also over there in Cottage Grove around for the flyovers on I-10. I'm sorry, I just don't think that going to the best-ranked law school is a detriment. I think it's a good thing for my district. I think it's a good thing that I was, you know, qualified enough to be admitted. I think that's a thing on its own. But I'm being taught by the people who write the textbooks that every other law student in the state reads. And so, you know, Austin is not a foreign country. I'm there a couple of times a month anyway. And I don't think it's my constituents think it's a good idea. I've talked to many of them, and they think that's just great. That even at 41, I'm willing to go back and do this. But I'm doing it for my district. I'm doing it to be a better representative, and going to the best school. I think it's a feather in the hat of my district.
State Representative Jessica Farrar, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks.